It's 2 o'clock, folks, and to be considerate of everybody's time, we go ahead and call this meeting to order. BJ, our chairman, had to be out of town today for a family emergency. My name is Jason Bliss. I'm on represent Benton County and also the vice chair. We'll just go around the table and do a quick introduction and then we'll get started.
And let her speak up.
Bob Gear, Franklin County Fire Chief Rep.
Erin Clay, Franklin County.
Chad McKenna.
So River, Benton Franklin Recovery Coalition.
Cindy Saunders, Benton County Mental Health Expert.
Ryan Washburn, Benton County Therapeutic Courts.
Matt Rasmussen, Benton County Commissioner's Office.
Brian Gates, Benton County.
Carla Crockett, Benton Health District.
Becky Gross, Franklin County.
John Roach, Franklin County.
Clark, Benton Franklin County, Benton Parish.
Doyle Chavez, Benton County.
Joe Says, Hillville Crockett, Benton Franklin County Superior Court.
Erin Martin, Townland Emergency Department Manager.
Thank you. I would like to entertain a motion to approve the minutes from our April 13th meeting.
Make a motion.
Can I get a second?
A second.
Is there any opposed to the motion? Motion carries. This will be our first public comment for the meeting. We will also have another public comment towards the end, but if anybody here who joined us from the public have any comment they'd like to add? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move on. Our first item up for discussion today is an update on contract of comprehensive health care for CRC.
It's just real quick update. I want everybody to know that I reached out to Edie at Comprehensive. We are going to have a quick phone call tomorrow to kind of outline how the process will go. And so then we have the committee here that's going to be a part of that. So once we kind of know what that process will look like for negotiations, but that's people on that committee, some time scheduled for the meeting. So that's the only update so far.
Matt, I have a question on that. I think when we last talked, there was going to be kind of a pre-meeting to talk about some of the concerns maybe
right
that have existed. Has that taken place?
No, that's going to be part of what we're going to do tomorrow, as I'm going to schedule that first meeting with the group that was selected from here and the branch from Comprehensive. So I was going to discuss that with me. Sorry, I'm looking at the process.
Are there any other questions concerning the contract or the progress of that? Okay, our next discussion item is an update on the Sobering Center.
So that one is also me. I was able to make contact with United Family Center. They do still have an interest in doing that. So I'm going to arrange with Berto to go take a look at the one of the buildings on the KGH property, which is actually zoned appropriately for that use. It also has some of the key components for the type of occupancy that we're looking at. It has fire sprinklers and a few other things. So much easier transition than potentially trying to convert the Tri-City Aero building, which is not zoned for it and does not have a fire sprinkler system. So we've also reached out to an architect. We got a list from the city of Kennewick about what is required to bring that up to an I2 occupancy, which is the occupancy they want to see for that facility. So we've engaged for engagement with our architect to go in and do an evaluation of that facility and give us a detailed list of what that would look like. So making some progress on it. As soon as I hear that, we'll update the committee.
Thank you. Our last listed item for discussion is discussion of top priorities list for mental health and substance use subcommittee. And I believe I've seen that list come out from Cindy.
Sure, I will start and go over the mental health priority, and then I think you go. So this is a carryover from last month when the committee agreed that maybe the mental health subcommittee and the substance use subcommittee should get together and each come up with a priority of something that maybe we could implement relatively quickly and hopefully get that done really soon. So several of us met on May 1st and walked through what our priorities initially were and what we thought we would want to see some up and running right now. And I did send this out. I only made a copy for myself, but hopefully you all had a chance to look at it. So for the mental health priority, we would like to maybe get a field responder program up and running relatively quickly. And what we thought this would look like would be a staff of two, one mental health counselor and one substance use counselor. Ideally, if one individual was duly credentialed as both, then the second person could be a peer, which would be great. This would be a team that would respond to the community when first responders are called. They could assess the individual, de-escalate as needed, kind of see what further intervention was needed, and then reach out to system partners such as crisis response, law enforcement, or fire as warranted. And what we would be asking the committee to do is essentially pay for the salary and benefits of those staff. So some of the questions that we needed the committee's response on were, we know that peak times for fire and rescue have been identified as 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. So we would like to identify when peak time for calls are for law enforcement. We don't have that information yet. We're assuming it's similar, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Then we would need the committee to decide what kind of coverage would we like. Was it one team during the day, two teams to cover all peak hours? What would we want the program to look like structurally, and what is most helpful for first responders? So we would need to get first responders input on that. And then who would employ the staff? We thought as our own little subcommittee that it would make most sense for comprehensive to employ the staff, that they would be their staff, but that the committee would pay their salaries. But again, there's other options that we could take. So that's what we had. We thought what we could do if we didn't want it to be comprehensive staff is that we as a committee could identify exactly what we wanted those teams to look like, some of those questions we talked about, and then present that to comprehensive and ask them to give us a cost of what they think it would cost to employ those staff. And then we'd also talked about if they're not credentialed as an MHP or an SUDP, which can take time, that there was an option that within a certain amount of allocated time, they could get that credentialing. We felt that it was really important to have the staff that respond have expertise in both mental health and substance use, because you never know what you're walking into. So either one of each or a duly credentialed and then a peer. So it's open for discussion unless you want to roll right into the substance use priority. We can talk about them together, however you guys want to talk about it.
Does anybody, we'll just kind of open it up for questions. Does anybody have any questions, thoughts, or comments?
So my question is just the demand. So in order to meet the demand, how many teams at any given time?
Right. And that's, I think we would need more information from law enforcement and first responders to see what they wanted. For me, I was thinking two teams for sure to cover all hours, but then you'd want, and they would cover based on that, but I didn't separate those out. What do you think?
I think that would be a good starting point to have two teams, and maybe we should look at, do we need to grow that or not? Bob and I talked earlier today, I think the peak hours would be good at night. I don't know that we'll have as much demand during that time. We could expand if we needed to, so I really like that idea. I'm interested in the deployment. Will this be in place of or in partnership with police and fire? And I think maybe it's a conversation on what that looks like. If there's not a true medical need, do we have them just go on their own, evaluate, and if they need police or fire? So I think there might be good to have some dialogue about that.
So my initial feedback on that, and certainly anyone else, the state right now has two frameworks in place for mobile response. One is a mobile response team that does not have a designated crisis responder, and they're just called out in situations to assess the situation and see what's going on. And then if a DCR is needed, then they would call the crisis team. And so we don't have that structure built in any of our 9 counties because we don't have the staffing and we don't have the resources. But it, to me, would parallel something similar to that, where this team of two, although a small team, would be called out and they would go in place of first responders. Obviously, if it was a medical need or there was a reason for paramedics, they wouldn't go, but I was thinking it would go in place of.
I think that would be the most beneficial. You know, there is an incredible amount of pressure on the system right now, and I was just at a fire station talking about, not that our people don't want to go, but they're not really the right resource. They're not trained, they're not equipped, so that would make the most sense to me.
Yeah. And I guess also, how would the team get the call? So some of those things we would need to work out, and maybe maybe those things we could work out with the contractor, whoever employed them, if it was comprehensive, we could work that out with them.
But the goal is for them to respond to an acute need, right?
Right.
So would that call come through 911?
In many cases.
I guess also, though, it wouldn't only be acute needs, because I think several people call 911 or law enforcement, and it's not an acute need, but they still need a response. And so this team could go out and do that as well and respond to those calls to see if there is a further need for follow-up.
Well, and we need to figure out how they, that's going to blend in with the resource advocacy programs that are in place in Pasco and Richland, who typically would do the follow-up after they respond to an acute incident and then pass those people on to our navigators to help them with the system. Even though at this point, our navigators do respond during the day when something's dispatched that obviously has a behavioral health component to the call, they go to the call as well.
That's why I would suggest an evening, because right now you guys are just days, right?
Or what?
Your staff are just day shift.
Yes.
So maybe if we staff this with evening to fill that gap.
I don't know. I don't see it replacing. I kind of see it working.
Well, that would be good to figure out how we work that together and how we keep the responder side from being bogged down in case management, which is what the resource navigators should be doing, just in case management and follow-up with the people.
I would see that more because, again, if you're going out to the field, you're dealing with it, and resource navigator would be tying in, finding out what kind of follow-up would need to happen, is more of what I would see.
I think with the two together would really alleviate a lot of the time first that you guys are going out to answer some of these unnecessary questions.
And then I think you also, in that, you know, when you look at the demand, you can figure out if it's critical. You could do, and police does this all the time, where they actually, you can kind of stack calls. So if you find one that maybe it's not super cute, it's not critical, we've got this call, we'll get over there after that. There's probably some of that could be done also. Not everything requiring an immediate response.
Right.
So are the thoughts that this program could somehow augment the current R&P program that we have out there that Cameron does? Because I know his group, they're currently now working with the police agencies in Richland, Kennewick, and Pasco. So I wonder if we could just add more staffing to a program that already exists.
Mm-hmm.
So the Recovery Navigator program, we cannot add more staffing to that. That's a specific contract that we have with the state. So it's built a certain way. But what we could do is these two could work together very well, where this field responder team could refer to the RNP program. So they could assess somebody and see if they need to go to that program. They could refer there and then they could take it over without even getting law enforcement involved. But we cannot enhance the RNP program any further than we have. Although if the funds were completely separate, I suppose we could. But
just add additional staff and then fund it through the behavioral fund. Just add additional staff.
But would that fill the role of what we're looking for here if we did that?
Well, I think a lot of what the chiefs are discussing and what you are discussing, the current R&P program does a lot of that now.
Yeah.
I know they're not ingrained with the fire departments as much as is needed, but there's been temporary workarounds. I know the chiefs have come up with a couple incidents where they need that, and there's been, I guess, workarounds to get them involved and get them to be able to help those individuals. But I'm thinking whether it's another contract or the system that's already in place, just to bring on a couple more staff. I don't know. I've always been one of the no sense of completely reinventing the wheel. It's there already. You know, maybe we could just augment that with another contract.
Well, and one way we could do that, if we wanted to do that, is that contract right now is through Three Rivers Therapy. So we could, instead of having comprehensive be the one that employs the staff, it could be Three Rivers Therapy. And then they could work in conjunction with their R&P program and still kind of have this model, but have it with the R&P program housed under the same facility. And then they could work together, still doing the same thing, just with the R&P program.
Yeah, because the R&P program, they're specialists, aren't they?
They I think they have some MHPs, but I think primarily they're peers.
Yeah.
They primarily.
Just here that you want.
Yeah.
Hello, this is BJ. I think it would be wise maybe to approach both organizations and see, you know, get feedback from them about what would be the best approach. Since they're kind of on the front lines already, and maybe take a look at, you know, a couple different options. I think that would be wise.
I think you would tie this into what the gap is we're trying to fill. What exactly is the gap that we feel we're missing?
The gap that, are you asking me?
Yeah, well, so the gap that I
feel like specifically.
I think this fills several gaps. Number one is when a first responder gets a call from somebody in crisis, that's taking their time away. Secondly, they're going to have to reach out to the crisis response team, which there's one in that serves both Benton and Franklin. So that is going to be a long delay of them getting out there to assess. And then several times, it doesn't require a designated crisis responder. You know, the analogy has been used several times, like Courtney has used the analogy where if you go to a doctor, you don't need a heart surgeon. So the heart surgeon doesn't have to come in every single time, but you still need to be seen by someone. So this would fill a gap of they're being seen by somebody who has specialties in mental health and substance use. They can get them into the right direction. And so it would fill several gaps. It's just what avenue do we want to take to get to there. And I do like BJ's suggestion about approaching both and presenting this idea to them and seeing what they could offer.
Yeah, I would just suggest like putting your stake in the ground, like this is our gap, and then keeping that your North Star as you build what you need. Don't lose, because it's easy to lose sight of what it is you're trying to accomplish in the first place.
But if I hear everybody correctly, it seems that what our gap is having the peers and mental health individuals directly embedded with the fire departments and those who go handle the calls. But I know we had talked about this at a previous meeting, but I often wonder, Kim, what would it look like if when a call came in, if the individuals involved in this program were dispatched rather than chats crew or Bob's crew to go out and handle it?
I think that's what we're talking about, Jason, is in place of not embedded. That co-responder model, talking with law enforcement, did not work well. So I think in place of either a police officer or a firefighter, so if I was in crisis, somebody would call and it wouldn't be the fire department or the police that would come out. It would be that mental health person that would come out and would start to interact with me. And then if there was a medical issue, then they could call police or fire, whatever would be appropriate.
Yeah. And who makes that decision? Is it a batch that makes that call?
Yeah, the dispatcher screens.
And is there any liability associated with that?
More than any other call.
Yeah. And we have process for that, and some some boundaries, you know, that we could follow. If it's this path, you go this way, or this way. Not any more than we already do.
I think there's stuff in the CD.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, there's stuff in there.
It's just getting this called right.
Yeah, it's just directing them a different way and being cognizant of where they may overlap.
Had similar discussions before about trying to tie this into being tied into dispatch for exactly that reason. It's trying rather than teaching a new number to call.
Yeah.
Everybody calls 911, there's an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. And our resource navigators have radios too, mm-hmm. right? So maybe they can have a radio so that they have a quick response if they get there and they need backup.
Yeah, they track it. The navigators arrive at a call just like any other fire unit, put themselves there, and they get status checked every 5 minutes or whatever it is while they're with people. And they clear the call. So we have that, all those numbers. We're generating all that number of times that we're seeing those people and how much time it is.
So is this like a need for,
we talk about the need for mobile data terminals and radios.
Yeah. Like an interim mobile response unit. Kind of like an interim solution.
I wouldn't think it's interim. I think it's something we'd want to keep going, because even when we start opening all the services at the recovery center, the law enforcement are still going to be getting the
calls. Still going to have those people that call that we don't know what to do with.
Yeah.
At the point of the phone call.
But maybe if once we get the contract going and we are able to meet the needs for that local crisis unit, then they can be folded into that contract maybe.
Well, it depends on how we talked about approaching too. It depends on if we go with comprehensive, they're already going to be their staff. We ask them to do this so they would
just roll right into the new fund, what we're doing.
I like the idea of talking with those two groups, but I would think we would also want to have some performance expectations for them too, though, that we would establish on how quickly would we want them to arrive. Not 45 minutes.
Right.
If it's gonna, people would become very upset with that, and then we're gonna be back in the issue of fire and police are gonna get called, hey, we need to get somebody out here, so. This sets some standard on what that looks like.
I think it needs to be a select team where their job is only to respond to this.
Yes.
Just those two, and there's gonna be downtime, and that's with any job where you're waiting around for a call. And then the location of where you'd want them to be housed, because they need to get somewhere quick.
We've kind of taken a stab at some of those standards in the first RFP that we did, and we ended up separating out the whole team from that. Because it was challenging to get some of those response times and things that we thought.
Perfect.
You know, I was wondering, because it would be public funds, if you'd have to do an open procurement.
No, it's a service. We can do any kind of procurement we would like to for a service, so, but it doesn't. It's always a good idea to look at multiple options, because you're getting this value for what you're spending. Not necessarily the lowest price, it's who's gonna give us the best service for what we're spending.
Cindy, you had mentioned, sort of alluded to the threshold of severity that needs to be crossed before crisis response gets involved, like the cardiologist versus GP analogy kind of thing. Is that, I mean, what is that? What is that threshold before the county is gonna send someone from the crisis response team out into the field?
I personally feel like Courtney might be able to answer that better, since she manages the multi. Do you mind answering that and giving kind of an idea of how, when your DCRs get a call, how they determine if it needs to be a DCR call or just a crisis worker call?
So the way we're currently set up is most of the time a DCR is the first responder.
What's a DCR?
Sorry, a designated crisis responder.
Thank you.
And we do have some people, crisis case managers that are bachelor's level that can also be dispatched. We have fewer of those than we do DCRs. So the reality is that, again, the way we're currently constructed, it really isn't a threshold. It's where's the crisis and who's available, and that, you know, that's how we dispatch. As Cindy said, most of the time we don't need a cardiologist. We're not doing open heart surgery most of the time. But the community, and this is every community that we're in, has gotten accustomed to a cardiologist coming in the room every time. And so that's kind of a shift that communities have to make when you try sending someone that's, you know, a crisis case manager, for example. But what you guys are describing, a mobile outreach team, I would advocate for more well-trained bachelor level and maybe some co-responding peers to go out with them as kind of your first line of defense, and then bring in the cardiologist when you need to. So a DCR, the other analogy I use is the SWAT team analogy. So when you call on a DCR, you're calling the SWAT team. And you don't always need the SWAT team. You can oftentimes manage the case, and it's expensive to call the SWAT team. So you really only need a DCR when you've got to that threshold of someone is at imminent risk. They're danger to themselves right then and there. They're danger to others right then and there. Or they're gravely disabled, and harm is going to come to them if we don't act.
So in a perfectly resourced world, you'd have this diverse team at varying levels of expertise and certification. And then at the point of dispatch, there'd be a screening done where the dispatcher would make the call based on some check down questions about who to send first. Whether do we need a DCR in this case right now? No, we don't. We're gonna send one of these other folks.
Yeah, John, I think that you raised a really good point. This is BJ again. So the question I would have, and maybe we don't need an answer for that today, but is dispatch doing the triage or is the person going out doing the triage? And I think it would be important to distinguish that, because otherwise you'll get some confusion about who's making the decision.
Both people do that because the initial triage is done by the dispatcher who decides whether this is a medical event that would include a medic unit, whether it's a single responder that goes to the crisis responder, but not necessarily a DCR, but whoever we're using at the time. And then when they get there, there's a secondary triage that's done when they actually encounter or make contact with an individual, whether they need to upscale, downscale, what they need to do with it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That makes sense. So the initial triage is the dispatcher, and then when the trained bachelor's level person can modify it from there.
And in my mind, it wouldn't be any different than the process you're using now. It's just that second person responding is not you. It's right. That team instead. So it's the same amount of calls. It's the same amount of triaging. Same amount of touch points for the individual. It's just a different person doing it.
And a model that we're already very comfortable with.
Right.
And what happens now with us is the medic unit gets dispatched to the call. They may get there and say, they'll call one of our, we've got a master level clinician during the day, and the two navigators, they'll call them and say, I think you need to come to this point. Stand by until you get here, and then they leave.
And so this actually would be maybe even removing one touch.
Well, this, if we shift, as we shifted the model, and obviously it's not going to happen overnight because there's training and, it's new units and different event types and all kinds of CAD language that has to be created in order to make it work. But yeah, they put in a certain event. You want to talk to your
guest?
Anyway, put in a certain event type. they just enter a certain event type and it recommends a crisis responder instead of a medic.
To add to the conversation across the nation, there's a lot of discussion about this in 911 centers and actually in our home state on the west side, Valley Communications, and there's one other one, I want to say it's South Sound, are actually working toward having clinicians in the 911 center that will take over calls that might be more geared toward their expertise and working together. So it'll be interesting to see how that works for them and if something similar to that could be something.
So I have a question. So Cindy, you mentioned that look at the crisis field responder teams, but there could be some downtime possibly. And so I'm wondering if that's the case, or if we've already done a true assessment of what the need is, and start with one for two fire departments or two police departments. Instead of one for each, because I'm thinking that if we just go with two right up at the start, it's going to further disrupt the workforce issue that we currently have if we're not fully utilizing those two teams. And also, if we do with whatever one we decide to go with, I think there also has to be some performance measures attached to the contract. For example, how many individuals were tied up, were connected to additional services after they're connected, and how many of those repeaters that use our system are, I guess, being connected to services are not reused the 911 service.
Yeah. So for good idea, the two teams I was thinking would be working on the same team essentially, but to cover the 9-to-9 shift. So you couldn't have one team working 9-to-9 every day. So just be split shift, but it would essentially be one team on at all times, but there'd have to be two teams to cover the shift.
Okay. How many FTEs then?
Four. Okay. Four total.
To cover that infrequent.
Yeah. And it would, I mean, we might even need more than that because of vacation time and all that. But if you wanted them covering 9-to-9 Monday through Friday, we'd need a minimum of 2 to 4 people.
Why Monday through Friday?
Just no answer. I just assumed
Monday. And I guess I thought from call volume perspective, is that accurate?
In terms of the timing, and we talked about it at our chief's meeting today, and everyone pretty much is in concurrence that we don't need a 24-hour at this point. But there's a few things that occur at 2 in the morning, but typically they can wait. And in fact, when we get a sobering center, there's a good chance that 2 in the morning, we end up there and we can make the contact the next day. Cindy, I'd like to see this run 7 days, so versus Monday through Friday, but 7 days a week, because Saturday.
Exactly.
Can get a little crazy.
So kind of stick to that.
So probably 6 then at minimum, right? 6 FTEs at minimum.
Well, and potentially, I guess what we can keep in mind is potentially the people that we already have employed could help backstop some of that as well. Because we already have the navigators who are making these contacts now and our clinician and.
I would worry a little bit about them going out by themselves.
Yeah, I don't.
I wouldn't do one person.
No, that's the person.
We do some one person follow ups.
Yeah.
But initial contacts are always at least 2 people with radio, talking to dispatch, the whole 9 yards.
But maybe that second person is a peer. Doesn't have to be the 2 bachelor's level.
Well, ideally that would be the best practice because peers communicate better sometimes with individuals in crisis and they relate to them better. So ideally it would be one person who has experience in mental health and substance use so they could cover both and then a peer. Yeah. That would be in my mind, the best situation.
Yeah, to prevent a bog down from follow-up needs.
Yeah.
We'd have to really think through some what referral pathways, like rapid referral pathways, would look like so that they're armed with the tools to do real quick warm handoffs.
Well, and again, that's where the navigators, I think, are going to come in. A lot of the people should get handed off to them, and then we can deal with the follow through of the continuum of care.
Yeah, so figure out what those pathways look like.
Yeah. And yes. You mentioned the recovery navigator program to refer anyone with substance use to them. So that's one direct referral immediately.
Is there any further comment or questions on Cindy's presentation?
Yes, my question is just what are the action steps to get this place?
So I kind of feel like we've identified what we want as a team. So maybe I could type that up, what we've talked about, and then we would just need to maybe approach comprehensive and Three Rivers Therapy to see what they would be able to, what the costs would be. Because again, we would be asking our committee and our commissioners to fund the salaries and benefits for those employees or any other costs associated with having or housing that employee. So I don't know what to do after that next step. Do we need to take it to the commissioners or how do we go about it next?
Yeah, it kind of gets back to, we had last month, and it gets back to the actual funding for all of these things. What the costs are, and the next step is start looking at
putting together a budget
overall and revenues that we have.
I'd also suggest bringing forward some sort of cost benefit analysis, right? I mean, this is going to cost us, but what is it going to save us, you know, in terms of taxpayer dollars and EMS runs? And you know, maybe we can't dial that in exactly, but we can get a pretty good guess on what percentage of those calls or not resulting in a medical emergency, but that are resulting in some sort of a psych or a type. I don't know if you type, you know, pull those out.
Mm-hmm. Baseline.
Yeah, we've run that in our records management system. We have a community healthcare module, and that's where all that information goes in, and we can report out on how many contacts, what type of contacts, how many hours, all that kind of stuff. So we have, you know, we're seeing 150 to 200 people a year with our resource navigators.
I don't disagree with you at all. I just, it makes me think of a couple of things. One, anytime I've been involved in a cost benefit analysis, it's a very time consuming process and it requires a lot of data gathering. And so that's going to just push it out further. And second, I think it's going to be really hard to determine the savings of time. So the savings of responding to a fire, the savings of responding to an accident. So we're taking time away from our first responders. How are we going to equate that with the cost that we're saving?
We might be able to help you with that because we ran numbers about when Becky, when we first started, before we started Resource Navigator, and 1% of the population of the city of Pasco was accounting for 10% of the calls, the same 1% over and over again. And now we've seen how that shifted. We're still making a lot of contacts, but we don't have that same 60 people that were accounting for 600 calls. So we do have some good data on that that would be fairly easy to put out, say, by using an alternative response model. Here's how many, potentially how many less full EMS responses were initiated and were handled at the resource navigator level.
Was that, Chief, was that coming out of the hotspotters group that was meeting for a few years there?
Our program?
Yeah, well, just the data, I mean, for.
No, the data is purely in our RMS. It's just like any other fire or medical incident report. It gets an incident number assigned and it goes into the CAD and period dispatch and it gets downloaded into our RMS system. And we all use the same RMS system, so we all have the same data capability within our system. We're just the only one that's had a program in place long enough to be able to say, we went from going to the same 60 people 600 times to 200 people, but only 5 times for each one, 10 times.
I think in for full transparency, probably Pasco's farther ahead than the other fire agencies would be to provide that information. If you were looking kind of throughout all of the counties for police and fire, it'd be a huge project and we just don't have that data right now.
I don't think we need detail. I think we just need to just bring it to the forefront. These are the costs, but we think that, you know, we're going to dial in the savings, but you know, it's at least.
I think it needs to be exact. I mean, it feels like too, along the same lines, but through a slightly different lens, there wasn't a cost benefit analysis in the formal sense that was necessarily put before the commissioners when they took the vote on the 1/10 of 1%. I mean, there was a series of meetings and a lot of advocacy from different organizations and different, you know, individualized statements of cost, but there was not, or at least I haven't seen it, formal cost benefit analysis around the concept of the one stump, right? It's sort of an apparent need that everybody can see. And it feels like for this, if it can be framed in terms of how this initial step, I think someone used a term before, but this is a step along the way. This is how this step fits into what we're trying to build overall. And if that can be made clear, I feel like it would probably be enough.
Because I think we have enough data to put an example out there of how it would work across the board.
Okay, so I guess maybe then the next step is we just, somebody maybe do Matt, reach out comprehensive and Rivers Therapy and ask them if they're interested in giving us a quote.
So I guess I'm wondering, why narrow it down to comprehensive and Rivers? Is it because?
Comprehensive because we thought if once they start up with the contract with the recovery center, then they'll just roll under that and they're going to be their employees. And then because of Three Rivers Therapy, because they house the recovery navigator program and this will parallel and work well with that program. So we chose those two, but if there's anyone else that you would like to ask.
I was just wondering if we could open it up to all the mental health agencies and treasurers, because I know that there are some that provide services, so they might be also willing to provide that added service.
I have no problem with that if the committee wants to do that at all. Will we continue this service once we get our mobile care unit going? Wouldn't that be a duplication of services? You don't think so?
I see this connecting with, like Bob said, I think there's a system that we're building, and the system is finding them out in wherever they're at crisis, tying them in with the resource navigator, and then we've got the facilities and the programs to get them connected with. So I just see this as a piece of the puzzle. I don't see this going away.
And right now, I think we took the mobile crisis response part out of the RFP. So that's not in our near-term plans, right? So then this might be a good solution.
Yeah, Comprehensive already had a mobile crisis response that they can dispatch. So we took it out of there. It was literally duplicating what they had.
This would be adjunct to that.
As far as reaching out, I mean, to me, it's on. I can do that. It might be better if a group of this committee had those initial conversations with a couple of the different
items over each side, if it's just there one to two, or if you want to reach out to a few, because you guys can articulate a lot of it.
I think if the committee is comfortable with it, then the mental health subcommittee can take on the role of typing this up and putting it, reaching out to some providers. And then I just wouldn't want to overstep how far you would want me to go, like talk to them about presenting a plan to us.
I think that's what we want to go, is present a plan. We need to get it for very cost, because we're going to have to weigh that against everything else that we have. The CRC operations, we have the proposal for the program jail. We need to have some at least preliminary cost analysis to go back. We don't want to go back to the commissioners and ask for things that we can't.
And then we can just ask for those basic things, and then when we see who's even interested, bring it back, and then start reaching out for conversations about the minutia of the contract and what it would look like and how the language would be written. Okay. So is everybody comfortable with the?
I'm comfortable with it. I guess I just do have a question. Is the procurement process is that we're subject to proven to be far less restrictive than I thought they would be going into it, but I'm still curious. At what threshold are we required or strongly encouraged to go through a more formal RFP the way that we did for the big contract versus
for services? The statute, the law, and the county policy is really just you should have some sort of competitive solicitation or just something to make sure you get. So if we just reach out informally to three or four. We're good. We can choose any process we want. It's very odd because construction is totally different. It has to have a very formal competitive process. Services, literally, you can call whoever the first person in the phone book and say, "You, I want you to come do this, and I don't care what it is." And that is your option. It's not a good choice.
And is that process for Benton County here? Right. In other words, we're not in an issue of the counties having different processes.
The law is the same.
Okay.
Across the state.
Yeah.
Unless they put a restriction on themselves that prohibits that, which I haven't unlocked. But ultimately, like the county, trying to deal with contractors. Payers, most contractors are going to want to deal with that.
So I do have a question. Maybe Cindy, you can answer this. I don't know if there's a benefit in having agencies that we approach to already have contracts with the managing organizations. I would assume, you know, obviously you pay for coverage, but there will be Medicaid billable services that will be tied to this also. So I think we have to fully fund the program. We have to make sure that whoever's providing the services is made whole. But I think it's a combination of our funding and what is able to be billed to Medicaid. Am I off base on that?
Well, that, I guess, brings up a whole other thing, because if we're asking the committee to pay for salary and benefits, then that's going to be guaranteed. We're not going to be asking for encounters from this team to prove what they did. But if the agency has contracts with Medicaid and they want to bill for those encounters themselves, is that what you're talking about? Then they could do that.
Yeah, I know that when we had early on, we had conversations with RI. They had talked about this and saying, you know, there is there's a portion of the services that will be recouped in billings of Medicaid.
Right.
It was a lot. I remember that. And so again, I know that there are going to be downtime, and there are going to be a lot of things that they probably do that are not billable services. But I think that If there are services that this team is providing that we can build Medicaid as opposed to our local funding, I think that makes sense to me, because it makes that other funding go further. And so I think, I don't know, that's in my thinking.
So if you're at the recovery center and you guys have contracts with Medicaid, then they will be billing Medicaid for those services. That makes complete sense. But right now, let's just use comprehensive as a sample. If they have this team in-house and they bill Medicaid services, that's going to go to comprehensive. It's not going to go to money unless you do a reconciliation with them and say, take it back. Or
yeah, and I think there would have to be some kind of an agreement
right.
And
And some kind of a true up.
The contract language would be written such that they need to back out the charges that for reimbursement that they occur. And you have to hope that they are doing their due diligence to build Medicaid and get reimbursed for what they can.
Can you incentivize that at any point?
I don't think they can get paid twice, once nope. by the county, once by.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's what the contract. They'd be double dipping.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be double dipping if they don't charge for the encounters, because you guys are not getting paid for going out and doing these encounters. And I don't even know that there's a Siri code honestly available for these encounters, but they wouldn't be double dipping if you're paying them for a salary and not the encounter. If we're paying for this, their encounters, then, and then they Medicaid reimburse them, then they would be. But we're not looking at paying for services, we're paying for an employee. And I think, I see where you're going with this, and you might want to reimburse a little bit of money, but I think that's going to be a deterrent for anyone wanting to do this, because that's a lot of work, or maybe a few encounters that you could get $20 each for.
We don't even know if it's available service,
right? We don't know if it's, but do you know, Courtney, if that kind of outreach would be available?
You have to build prices.
You have to build prices of services, so.
And you have to recognize that not all MCO contracts are fee-for-service contracts. It's not a one-for-one.
Yes.
So there are contracts that exist that it doesn't matter if an agency does 500 contacts or 5,000 contacts, they will still get the same amount of money. So that's just something to keep it in the back of your mind.
It's also the way that we pay our crisis teams. We pay them on a capitated basis. So we pay them a set amount every month, and they have to see everybody with that funding. So if this rolls under them, then it's just going to be adding more people, more services to what they're already doing.
There's probably criteria, right? It has a counter, right? Mm-hmm. Which we don't want that to be a barrier to these folks.
Right.
Yeah.
I would think that this program would be similar to the PATH program. And in that, it's sort of outreach to homeless with mental health and substance use. I think that the program just pays for the person that goes out and does the encounters. Not there isn't a billing process for that. I think that when we're talking about getting Medicaid reimbursement, I would say that's probably more for the crisis response or the crisis center. Or other ancillary services that would be more fitting in with the mental health counseling or substance abuse counseling, and that would be an allowable service. It would be really difficult, I think, to come up with a billable outreach unless somebody was already enrolled in somewhere, someplace, and then that provider could possibly bill for outreach at that point. But I think in this case, it first of all, you don't even know if the person's going to be enrolled in Medicaid anyway, so you'd have to get them enrolled anyway. I just think that would be an administrative nightmare, actually.
I agree
with BJ too. I think if we decide that this is a critical program, we have the funding, let's fill that into the budget, make sure that we're not in a position where we're counting on some funding coming in and then later on we have problems.
Yeah,
I think it makes sense to pay for it, build it into the budget if we said it's one of our most critical programs.
I agree.
At least 600 plus equipment, vehicles, it's going to be at least 600,000 a year, not 700,000. Yeah.
Well, and that's how our true limit basically corresponds to all of the grants we all salary benefits. Like, so, all that, but,
So then when the PCR went out and did responded on those calls and did an investigation, that was to go back to anything.
Switched to happen. So if it became you were doing evaluation, you took the mobile outreach team hat off, you put your PCR hat on, we're no longer a mobile outreach team, you were doing a crisis evaluation. Documenting other prices, you didn't document. Is there any other comment or question in Cindy's presentation?
I just have one more question. Since Joel brought up other providers, I just want to make sure I don't leave anybody out that any of you want me to reach out to. What providers would you like me to reach out to? See Comprehensive, Three Rivers Therapy, Lawrence Counseling Center, United. Yeah. Are those the main four? Anyone else? Okay.
Catholic?
Catholic
services. I think they have a small amount of.
Of adults? I'll call Ken Brands. Okay. All right.
Thank you. Rebecca?
I don't have a presentation per se, but our input on that was the silver and services as our priority, which you gave us an update on where we're at with that, Matt. So do we want to have a conversation around that? I mean, I know we've talked a lot about it. We just still stand behind that as being our number one priority. We feel really strongly about getting some sort of a, you know, a sub-acute sobering services stood up quickly.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the adult KGH would probably, just from what Matt outlined, probably be a wise
hotel building. It's old buildings to the board on the north part of the property. It's got the weird round sides.
Oh yeah, this Spalding.
This Spalding building?
No.
It used to be the Vista Family Health.
It used to be this one.
No, it's yeah. Kind of it's got kind of rounded
corners. Yeah, but it's a standalone. It's 13,000 square feet. It's got fire sprinklers in the basement.
Weird. I guess nobody cared back then.
Well, the thing is, the uses were different upstairs, but probably administrative uses and downstairs clinical uses. That's all we can figure. There, when we walked around in there, there clearly been some unpermitted remodeling going on. You've had war outlets halfway into a wall. But it does have a lot more. I mean, bringing in a fire sprinkler system to an existing structure. That's a big cost saving, time savings for us. The evaluation done, we'll have the architect evaluate that, and I'll set up a time here, hopefully next week, to go meet with the United Family again. I think they wanted to see the facility. They were interested in using that instead of their own building. They also recognize that getting it set up in their building is probably, I mean, to be honest, it's unlikely to happen. The city's unlikely to comprehensive
would this be a bi-county effort? I know there was some conversation a few months ago about Franklin County doing their own thing on this.
It's up to Franklin County. What they, I mean, definitely all of these things for us, for Benton County, is we're absolutely on both sides. Ultimately, Franklin County has decided what they want to do. It sounds like the discussions with United Family were approached from both sides. So I don't know why that would have changed.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think.
No.
Went in a different direction.
Okay.
We just need to get a facility. We didn't really care.
Okay.
Achieve something.
Where?
Yeah.
So we did care, but we wanted to go camping. Not basketball, but.
So what do we anticipate meeting if United comes back and says he does a go ahead?
So that I think it would be a very similar path there is let's get a proposal from them. Probably need from this committee more details on exactly what we're looking for. So we can give them on that and have them come back and give us a cost. And part of that will also be the cost to upgrade the building or whatever retrofitting is needed to make it into that use. So there will be some. It's not going to be just move it and go. But so we'll continue to work on all of it. So I think maybe from your committee side is maybe start thinking about those kind of deliver those expectations of what the service will actually be exactly what we want it to provide. Give that to them and say proposal based on this. They have a loose idea of what we're looking for, but it's something we're going to tie that down.
Seems like there was some real positives around that Spokane facility that many people looked at. Right. Is it worth acquiring the contract from Spokane so that we can mirror?
I've asked the lady in Spokane to get those and all about three, and just back 2 days ago.
Okay.
So I'll make sure. I think the sobering one is privately done. It has nothing to do with the county, I'd say. Right.
I think the sober unit, we looked at that. They could make ends meet starters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More so. I think that's more the model. Did you reach out to them for a sample contract?
They didn't have a contract.
Well, we reached them. We were able to.
Yeah, we were there. We met with them. They just didn't currently have anybody in the clients in the building.
Were they? Actually contracted with the county or the city to do that, or were they just on their own standing up the facility?
Well, I know that they had, I know that they had a response model, kind of like we were looking for. They actually had their own car, van number 9 or something.
R50.
Yeah, it had radios and lights and the whole 9 yards. They would respond when they got calls.
I think that's two things that I would like to see. One is that they would have the capability to transport. I used to volunteer right across the street. I'm in Spokane from that one. So I'd see them bringing people in frequently to that. It seemed like it was a good model. The other is the ability to do some medical assessment on the people that we also talked about. I think that would be important, that they have somebody there that can screen to figure out, are they okay? Are they safe there? Do they need to go to the hospital and have some kind of medical
Yeah. So they said that they had their funding through the BHO, through a block grant.
They did get most of the ASO over there in Spokane gave them quite a bit of funding, and then they contracted with managed care organizations for a capitated rate to keep them whole. But when I had talked with them maybe a year and a half ago, they said some of the managed care organizations were not wanting to pay that capitated rate where they would pay for a certain amount of beds, whether they had someone in there or not. And so they were looking at some financial difficulties because of that. But then the county, if we had county funds, it would be a little different. I'll ask him if he has that agreement. Yeah.
That could have contract expectations, at least care delivery.
What their staffing level was?
They had 16 beds.
I want to say that was two
to three at all times.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, 1 to 7 staffing ratio is what I said.
At night, it's a little higher during the day because we have bad things. And now that we bring up the funding piece, that is the issue that they ran into. Because if I remember right, they had some BHO and county funding, but their reimbursement rate, it got slashed to less than half of what it was, and they no longer could sustain.
Well, we're talking about this prior year in the services, and that's what you guys are talking about. So there's
no,
we're talking about stars.
We're talking about stars.
Yeah, but that's the one that was struggling, which you're talking about. The BHA is no funding.
I wrote down that they said that's what they're.
Yeah, Star said that they had BHO funding.
Block grant.
Yeah. I'm not, that's just what they conveyed.
Yeah, they said they had a contract with Spokane Fire Department for that. So I don't know if we could maybe get that information from.
I thought Pioneer was contracted with the county.
That's who, well, we toured and we talked about the 16 facility. They had 16 mental health, they had 14, 16. It's all in the same roof. That is
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were contracted with Spokane County.
So Pioneer is also contracted with the MCOs. And actually, Pioneer Human Services is really struggling right now. They're looking at closing down two facilities, the one in Spokane and the one I think it's in Seattle.
Isn't it, Joel? Is that just because of reimbursement rates again? Is that what the struggle is with those ones?
Part of it is well, I really can't say it's a reimbursement rates. I know it's not our reimbursement rates. I think they're really struggling with filling the beds and keeping staff.
It's kind of like a death spiral. If you can't keep staff, you can't have a high acute, you can't keep your beds full, you can't keep your beds full, staff need to go somewhere else. And we're seeing that in facilities across the entire state.
So it was just, it was day and night difference, I guess, as far as clients, if you will, at both places. When we went to Pioneer Centers first, all of those beds that you spoke about, one was 16, 16, 12, or something like that,
darn near every bed was full that we looked at. And then we went over to the Stars one. It was a ghost town.
Is the reimbursement model different between the two?
Are there any more other comments, suggestions, concerns on steps moving forward?
Do we need a motion for Cindy to proceed with outreach to the prospective service providers, or is that okay? Thank you.
I'll entertain a motion for Cindy to be able to proceed and reach out to the prospective providers and talk about the issues that we talked about today.
So moved.
Second.
Are there any opposed to the motion?
So kept, Cindy.
It's actually the mental health subcommittee, but.
At this time, moving on in our agenda for today, is our second time for public comment. Anybody here from the general public have any questions, comments, concern on the direction we're going? Yes, Nancy.
We currently have in the fund for behavioral health in two counties.
To be honest, I haven't checked in several months. Last I checked, we had just short of $3 million in our side, and I think Franklin County was around two something. They've had this a little longer. So I can double check that though and send that out, at least from the Benton County side. And I can ask Franklin County. So.
Okay. Any other comment or question from the public? Seeing none, we'll move on. Is there any other new business or any other business for the betterment of the committee today?
I have two things.
Chill.
One is when we chose the name of the Three Rivers Behavioral Health Center, it was Matt, Jerome Delvin, myself, and Andy Miller, and none of us knew that there was a private business called Three Rivers Therapy. We did not know that. We would not have chosen the name because there would be confusion. So I would like to ask if this committee would consider bringing forth some other suggestions for names, and then we might choose a different name for the facility.
So the facility or the?
What facility?
The recovery. Because the recovery center.
Everything we submitted is called the Three Rivers Behavioral Health Recovery Center.
Oh, I didn't even know.
So.
And we, I know at the
computer.
Our recovery coalition gets a lot of messages about the confusion. Is that you? Is that, you know,
yeah,
in a private business? So I'd like the committee to consider a different name.
I like that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks. Nice one. Yeah, I would say if people want to think about naming for it, I think kind of I'm open to anything. I'm terrible at naming things. I'm an engineer. I'm very literal. If you ask me to name it, it's going to be the Bruno Street Recovery. Yeah, no, and especially as Three Rivers Therapy has grown and expanded here, it's even it eventually become official.
Well, and there's the Three Rivers Counseling on top of it too. Yeah, so
if anybody has,
right now it's only called that in grant application.
Okay.
Actually that, so there's official. Back in the RFP, we just called it the Behavioral Health Recovery Center.
Yeah.
The name of, so.
So if anybody has any suggestions, please bring them forward to the next meeting. Then we'll have further discussion and take a vote.
Thank you. I have another thing to bring up, and that is that I would request that the county develop a spot on the county website dedicated to the recovery center. Again, because the coalition is getting a lot of inquiries. How can we link to the official county website for the recovery center? And it isn't a space there. So I'd like to request that that be happened.
I would encourage that for both counties. I see Mike Gonzalez has been on the call. He was, his face was up there earlier. He went off camera, so I don't know if you're still listening, Mike, but you are bringing a new era of transparency and communication to the Franklin County operations there. And I think it would be great if that was a you know, double outreach from both counties.
Glenn, you have no son.
You're welcome, Glenn. I have one more thing. The workforce issue. I have talked to our legislators about the long periods of practicum that are required in this field and for social work and to become an LMHC. And I've talked to some of the legislators on the other side of the aisle that have been our benefactors. And I think we can definitely ask for and get a bill next session to look at, or perhaps go right ahead and shorten some of those practicum periods, because there's no budget ask, and therefore we could bring that up in a short session legislature. People are inclined to believe that some of these practicum periods are too long. I think we can go forward with that.
Well, that's definitely something that's in the community health improvement plan, you know, addressing workforce shortage issues. So where we can partner to start to craft an ask that list.
Great.
Is there any other new business or any
Jason,
other?
I have one.
Yes. Some of you may have heard a rumor about me retiring the end of the month, which is true. I am retired at the end of the month. But the Franklin County Chiefs have asked if I would continue as a retired chief still representing them on this committee, if that's all right with the rest of it. So.
Yeah, great.
Yes.
We'll allow it.
Not really.
Well,
I'm just now you're just going to not get paid.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sort of like being retired.
And I approved that plan as a Franklin County.
As a Franklin County resident, I enjoy his free labor.
Okay, I have something also. So in regards to budget, a little bit of discussion last month about the budget, and I wasn't here for that, but I was wondering, I think sometimes when we're talking about some of these programs, and then hearing how much they might cost, there's some sticker shock associated with that. And I was wondering if maybe we could get some very rough estimates. I know coming up with a budget is a lot of work, but going, like, do we have an estimate of how much money we're going to be collecting on a yearly basis? And then a rough estimate of how much we think it's going to cost to run these facilities. And then so we can see how much we actually are going to have left over. Because if we're making $10,000 a year, collecting $10 million a year, and it's gonna cost us $3 or $4 million to run the programs, I'm making these numbers up. And we as a committee know, wow, we have $7 million extra, then $800,000 a year doesn't sound as much as if we thought. So if we kind of went into this knowing these services are gonna cost us money, and how much do we have to play with, then it's gonna not be as much of a sticker shock when we talk about it.
That was a conversation.
The revenue side of it is easier. It's the expenditure side of it that I'm still not.
Okay.
We have some, like when they came and presented the mental health poverty, they had a very hard number. And I don't have a hard number for the CRT. Maybe get some idea from grants as we start into the contract negotiations without holding them to that. Just a ballpark.
Or just a ballpark of what we think we might have left over. Sorry, that's what you talked about last
week. Yeah, because we did get the presentation and it really felt like we're kind of going car shopping without knowing how much our paychecks can be. So I think collectively, most of us kind of felt like we would like to see that information.
Okay. There's so much response need that we need to figure out how to address, but if there is a little bit that we can put into prevention so that we can look upstream, that would be excellent to know as well.
Well, the other piece of this that we always, we can, as counties or as this committee, there are tons of grant fund options out there for operational expenses and we don't seriously be looking at as we have some of these programs and we get these ideas, we should be going and looking and trying to leverage our own funds with state funds and other dollars that are being used.
Yeah.
lot further. Yeah, I, the revenue side, I can with her finance person, we'll be back next week. She can give me the historical, make a revenue projection. That's pretty easy. It's the expenditure side of it. It's just not clear yet.
Well, yeah, definitely a rough estimate of the expenditures for sure, but kind of a moment.
Any other new business? Thank you all for coming to this meeting, Senator.